Since the dawn of civilization, spies of every nation and culture have worked to infiltrate their adversaries and glean the information that will give their side the advantage. The stakes are sky high, the strategies varied and imaginative, and the ultimate sign of success is that no one ever even knew you were there. In each episode, we will explore the moral and ethical gray zones of espionage, where treachery and betrayal go hand in hand with cunning and courage. This is the Spycraft 101 podcast. Welcome to your clandestine classroom. In every era of history, spies have been issued special equipment to do their jobs. Some of it is high tech, some of it is down and dirty, but that purpose-built gear is a force multiplier. So, how'd you like to get your hands on some? Our friends at Covert Products Group make a wide range of tools out of unconventional materials like titanium, G10, carbon fiber, and even 3D printed stock. These tools are designed for utility, concealment, and escape. What really sets their tools apart is that you can travel just about anywhere with them, legally. They call their travel-friendly line the BAT Collection, short for Bring Anywhere Tools. They're up to 3 or 4 designs at this point, and I heard that there are more in the works. Many of their products are OSS and SOE inspired, but made with the modern world in mind. They also release small runs of self-defense-oriented products from time to time. Good stuff. You can find them online at covertproductsgroup.com. I'd recommend signing up for their email list while you're there, and I know they won't spam you. Once again, that's covertproductsgroup.com, and use the promo code SPYCRAFT101 at checkout for free shipping in the U.S. This is episode number 10 of the Spycraft 101 podcast. I'm speaking with Jack Barsky, also known as Albert Dietrich, and his daughter Chelsea Dietrich. Jack was born in East Germany, and while still in college, was recruited by the Stasi and later by the Soviet KGB. After extensive training in the Soviet Union, he arrived in the United States to begin his mission for the USSR for the next 10 years. Chelsea grew up knowing nothing of her father's true background for many years. I'm very excited to finally have the chance to speak with someone with Jack's unique experience and perspective on the Cold War, and to hear from Chelsea what it's like to be the family member of someone leading a double life like this. Jack, Chelsea, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. Jack, can you take us back all the way to your time in college? What was it that made you an attractive recruit for the Stasi at that time?
Well, to begin with, I was a pretty smart kid. I also had, you know, this is nothing to brag about. This is what I was given at birth. But I also had very good work habits. So I aced high school, and then I was well on my way to acing college as well. And that was a difficult, difficult task. And so I also was active in the youth movement. I was a member of the party. We had no relatives in the West, so I was a really, really good target to take a look at with regard to would I be a good candidate for espionage, just like the CIA, the KGB recruited from the top. And so I think I got the attention when I received a national scholarship that was limited to just 10 100 concurrent holders. So that was, I mean, that made me into the elite of the student body, of the national student body. And so towards the end of my third year in college, I was approached by somebody who spoke on behalf of the KGB.
So how did they approach you, and what was it that made this an attractive offer to you?
Well, the offer didn't come until a year and a half later. The approach was just, let's get to know each other. The question really was, could you imagine one of those days to be working for the government? And I instinctively knew what he was about, because in those days, nobody recruited out of college. You were given positions, you were assigned. So I could have made the guy blush a little bit by asking what part of the government, but, you know, I played the game and I told him, yes, but not as a chemist. So we were communicating between the lines, and he got the answer that he wanted. That means I was ready to talk with these guys. I was just curious as to what came next. And what came next, he introduced me to a Soviet citizen who spoke German really well. And before you know it, the first contact, the German, disappeared, and I was now connected to the KGB. But that meant nothing. The offer, they needed to find out whether they really wanted to make me an offer. And there was a lot. They were looking very, very hard for special candidates with a lot of character traits and abilities that are hard to find as a package. And I had to, you know, become confident that I really wanted to do this job. Because, you know, all I ever knew was, you know, how the East German version of James Bond operated. And that was a lot of violence and kicking people in the groin and gun stuff. And I wouldn't have wanted to do that. But I wanted to do the adventurous part, you know, the travel and the, you know, and, you know, helping to defeat the evil enemy, capitalism. So I'm going to stop right here. Otherwise, I'll talk for the next hour.
Okay, sure. So how much did they tell you about what you would do during this process? Was it all, were you kept in the dark about what they truly wanted you for? Or did you have an idea that it would involve, you know, coming to the United States later on?
Initially, the United States was not in play. They were looking at me as a German who could easily blend in with the West Germans with some minor cultural adjustments, making sure that I didn't have a, you know, one of the local accents of which there are quite a few. But anyway, they wanted me for West Germany. As with regard to, in general, telling me what it was like, it was a steady drip of information. I met this handler of mine once every 2 weeks, and we would just talk, and he would, you know, give me some idea what it was like to do espionage. He would also give me some tasks. And so it was a very long feeling each other out. I actually had one trip to Berlin where I was introduced to the head of the KGB stationed in Berlin, not the head of the KGB, but the Berlin contingent. And this guy then made me an offer. And it was an offer that the question always comes up that I could have refused. He was pretty adamant. He said, okay, so I didn't answer. I said, I want to think about it. He said, I'm not going to give you much time. I want an answer by tomorrow noon. That was a rather sleepless night that I spent that night, because I was still 50-50. I didn't know. On the one hand, I really loved what I was doing. I had a great career ahead of me. I loved where I lived. And, you know, life was going to be really good in East Germany for me. On the other hand, there was this opportunity to become a hero for the worldwide communist revolution and be able to have my cake and eat it too, namely going to the West, traveling around and benefiting from what I knew was a higher standard of living produced by a society that I was going to help destroy. So it was fundamentally a tough decision, but ultimately what made me say yes was the sense of adventure and the flattery to be recruited by the most powerful intelligence agency in history, which I didn't know at the time, had about 100 million employees. No, what am I saying? 100. 1 million. 1 million full. No, 1 million full-time employees, but probably 3 to 4 million volunteers. So it was clearly, it was the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, the whatever. It was everything that rolled up into one organization. And, you know, being recruited by that organization, by what I thought was the most powerful nation in the world, equal to the United States, that helped too. So, you know, the decision was 51-49. So I said yes.
Wow. Okay. And that brings us here for sure. So what did you tell your family at that point, now that you're taking on this unexpected career path?
Yeah. So I had, my first cover story was that I would be moving to Berlin because I was recruited by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and I was going to be a diplomat. My mother was really surprised. She said, really? And then, you know, I was in the apartment where she lived, and my brother was there too. And my mother was, she had a brainstorm. She said to me, are you going to be a spy?
Oh, my God.
And intuition. But my brother helped me out. No. I would never do something like that. No, don't worry about it. So he saved me because she shouldn't have known. The reason was that she was very emotional and she would have leaked. So, you know, I explained to her, you know, a diplomat, I get to travel and it's great. I represent our country. So she eventually bought into that story while I was in Berlin. But then 2 years later, I was moved to Moscow. The cover story didn't change. I was now a member of the diplomatic mission in Moscow. But when I went to the United States, that was a different story because my mother was very actively always looking to find me. She came to visit me in Moscow, and that raised the alarm bells because thank God she didn't go to the East German embassy. She wouldn't have found me there. I changed cover story again. I told her that I rediscovered my love for chemistry and I was going to join space research in the Soviet Union, that it was done by in cooperation of all the communist countries that were allied with the Soviet Union. And the location was Kazakhstan, in a highly secret area that you couldn't get close to without permission. So that way she couldn't possibly even attempt to find me.
Hmm. Okay, I see. So that sounds like a great cover to me. I mean, she can't contact you, but she knows that you're safe. She knows that you're not that far away, really.
Yeah.
Still in the Soviet Union, so.
Okay. And in order to keep up appearances, I pre-wrote letters in handwriting and postcards, birthday card, and so forth, in Moscow that then were periodically released, so that my mother had the idea that, you know, I was actually writing. At one point, she complained that I never answered her questions. But she never really doubted that I was in Kazakhstan. She, till the very end, she thought I had been there, I was there. And when the wall came down and the Soviet Union was about to disappear, she wrote a letter to Gorbachev asking his help to find me.
Oh my gosh. She's determined.
Yeah, she was.
Wow. So once you moved to the USSR, what were you working on? Like, what was your training like during that time?
Well, I moved to the USSR to learn English because they had a couple of people who were Native Americans who could teach me American English and also teach me to the extent they still remembered, because they had left the United States probably 20 years before. Tell me something about what it's like to be an American, because it's one thing to speak the language, is another thing to actually behave like an American. And that's where I had quite a few gaps, even after the advice that I had gotten. The other thing, I had been trained in spycraft in Berlin pretty well. So there was some maintenance. You know, I periodically listened to shortwave radio to keep my shortwave listening skills, Morse code, on par. And I occasionally did a practice letter in secret writing. But what I really learned very well in Moscow was counter-surveillance, and particularly, you know, getting out into the city and determining as to whether you're being followed. That's an art. And you cannot ever do things that will give you away. So you cannot turn the head. You cannot do something obvious. You need to behave like a normal person. But while you're doing this, you choose a route where the people that follow you have to come close enough, at least one of them, that you can see their face. And if during a period of 3 hours you see the same face twice, no matter what else what clothes they're wearing, you see the same face, you know that you're being followed. And that helped me down the road, particularly when I quote unquote resigned from the KGB, to determine as to whether the FBI was actually on my case or not. Turned out the KGB, they thought the FBI was on my case. They were convinced. And I determined I was very secure in my determination that that was not true. So that was it. That was it. And then they gave me, you know, books to read, and I got self-defense training in Moscow. No weapons training, by the way, just self-defense, little jiu-jitsu. And that was it. It was mostly, I mean, I did English, I would say, at least 8 hours a day, if not more.
Wow. This English teacher you said was a native-born American. Was this a defector or what?
Exactly? I'm guessing that was a woman. I'm guessing she fell in love with a Soviet diplomat or a Soviet KGB agent or somebody who was both and decided to follow him to Moscow. She regretted that, even though she never openly stated that. But I could feel that, because she was just, you know, she was made out of the fabric of sadness. She was a stranger in a strange land. She never learned to speak Russian really well. And she lived in a rather cramped, with what's supposed to be a luxury apartment, rather cramped apartment. She shared it. The husband I never saw, but there was also an adult child. So, yeah, that poor woman, I guarantee you she regretted having gone to Moscow. So have many others. But
I have heard that's kind of a common theme with some defectors, is that they have some second thoughts once they actually land there.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Yep. In the days when she left the United States, there was still this romantic notion about, you know, how wonderful the Soviet Union was and was going to be. It was all false.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's unfortunate for sure. But I guess once you're there, you can't easily make your way back. Can't change your mind.
I don't know. She could have gone to the American embassy and says, hey, can you take me back? Because she just left the country. She didn't betray anybody or anything. She was an ordinary person. She was not she was not somebody who had secrets.
Okay. That's a good point. I wonder whatever happened to her then.
I don't know. She's not with us anymore. She was much older than me those days.
Okay. I see. So you were eventually – Your English is very good, obviously, now, and you're selected to come over here. So how exactly did that occur? How did you make your way to the United States once you completed your training?
How much time you got?
There'll never be enough, I'm certain.
In hindsight, I'm thinking this was one of the best thought out and executed operations of my entire career. The focus was that the Jack Barsky ID that I was going to take on within a couple of days of entering the United States could never be traced back to Moscow. And so there were several legs in that travel, that, and it was step by step. As I got on a plane in Moscow, and that plane went to Belgrade, then Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia was a somewhat friendly socialist country that had some disagreements with the Soviet Union, but it was not a Western country. It was not NATO. So from Yugoslavia, I took a train to Vienna, Austria, which was a neutral country. In Vienna, I changed my false West German passport for another false West German passport. With that passport, I crossed the border on a train to Rome, Italy, where I changed passports again. This time, and this was done with, I met one of the diplomats that were actually KGB in the respective countries. This time, the false passport was for Canadian. With that passport, I then made my way to Mexico City. And after one week of you know, getting rid of jet lag, I hopped on a plane that was going to Toronto, my hometown, quote unquote, but with a stopover in Chicago. And I just left the plane in Chicago and entered the United States as William Dyson, a citizen of Toronto. And within a couple of days, I killed William Dyson by destroying his passport and became Jack Barsky, because I had a genuine copy of a birth certificate under Jack Barsky in a secret compartment in my luggage. Now, think about it. All I had at that point was a birth certificate, no other ID. But in those days, you could do fundamentally everything that you can think of without requiring ID, as long as you had cash. So I could walk on a plane. I paid for a ticket in cash and flew to New York. There was no security. You could get a hotel room. You didn't have to show ID. It was a completely different world in those days.
Wow. Yeah, I can imagine. So you had, my understanding, you had four different identifications between four different aliases between the Soviet Union and arriving in Chicago or?
No, there was three altogether.
Okay.
But you see that it was, and the KGB knew very well. I think they had their own people embedded in border services. They knew where on entry or exit the border police would place stamps in your passport. And so, for instance, when I came to the United States, there was no indication that I was ever in Rome. Well, I already changed passports. So there was no indication that I had entered Mexico from some other place. Yeah, I'd entered Mexico, but I could have been from the United States. So they really knew what they were doing in that respect. I was not traceable back anywhere near that route where I came from.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, sounds like they did their homework for sure in that case.
Oh, yeah.
So what were your first few days and your first few weeks like in the United States? Was it surprising? Was it difficult? Was it unexpected?
No, I had a task, okay? My task was to find a place to stay. That was the first a reasonably priced place where you would pay by the month. And, it wasn't that easy. I wound up in a questionable type single room occupancy hotel where it was frequented by folks that were on drugs and hookers and so forth. But, I couldn't spend $1,500 a month. I didn't have that much cash. I also needed to find a place where they told me that I needed to have clear view of the southern sky, which to me indicated that they were worried that the radio transmissions came out of Cuba. And they were worried that if there was a wall in between, the reception wouldn't be that good. It turned out to be wrong. But anyway, it took me a couple of months to get to a place where I could settle down and spend a year before I had the documentation that I needed to be fully functional in the U.S., The two documents that were key were the driver's license and a social security card. And it wasn't easy. So as I said, to answer the question, I had a mission and I spent a lot of time in pursuit of that mission. And the other thing is I walked the city. I walked New York. Every day I was out. I got to know the city as well as anybody, probably better than most New Yorkers, because the city was my playground, was my operational field. I needed to know where the parks are, what parks could be used for debt drop operations, spots that you could use to find whether somebody's following you and so forth. So when the weather was good, I was out. Okay. Mm-hmm. When it wasn't, I spent a lot of time in movie theaters where you could get a double feature for $1.50.
So your first year, you said, was establishing yourself and
yes,
familiarizing yourself with the location. You didn't have to collect any intelligence for that first year.
Is that right? No, that would have been stupid. I was trained, so to speak. I was directed that my main task was eventually to collect political intelligence, in other words, foreign policy, military policy, and so forth, get close enough to decision makers or at least influencers so I could, give valuable information to the Central Committee back in Moscow. That didn't work out so well because I never attained the standing in society, at least while I was working for the KGB, to have a good reason to befriend, people of conservative think tanks or even government employees. And anyway, in New York didn't have those government employees. And I stayed in New York for the entire 10 years I was active.
So how were you communicating back to Moscow, so to speak? You mentioned some radio signals coming from Cuba.
Yeah, I got weekly shortwave transmissions. They were doubly encrypted. You probably are familiar with the groups of five, all digits, that for some reason many intelligence services use to transmit messages. That was once a week. Twice a month, I was allowed to answer or whatever, ask questions or what have you via a letter in secret writing, but I was limited to two sheets of paper so as to not create a letter that would be too thick and maybe come to the attention of people who were searching mail. And this letter would be sent to, I had several convenience addresses. I remember one was in West Berlin, one was in Vienna, and one was someplace in South America. So these were collaborators with the FBI that received the mail. They knew when it came from the United States, they knew what to do with them. They notified local residents of the KGB. They met them, gave them a letter. And that letter then was put in the diplomatic pouch sent to Moscow. You know, it's an awkward way of communicating and completely different, but much safer than meeting your handler in the country where you were operating. That was forbidden. It was way too risky.
Oh yeah, that makes perfect sense, honestly, especially if your handler's already been identified and is under surveillance. That would be what they would want to
Yes. Learn. Yes. The FBI, I've met enough ex-FBI folks that would tell me they knew pretty much who was KGB, who wasn't. They couldn't cover them all because there were too many of them.
Right. That requires a ton of surveillance to have eyes on them all the time.
Yes, but it was still, even if they could cover only half of them, it was too risky. And you know, one contact with one of those known agents and I'm dead.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine. So
yep.
Along the way, I mean, you're here for 10 years and you can't really communicate with your family and you came here not knowing anyone. So were there times when you regretted taking on this assignment or times that you were, you know, kind of feeling low and wishing you had done something else? Or did it just feel like your new life?
Nope. And I had the opportunity to go back to Germany every 2 years. So these were, I think, four trips via Moscow. And Moscow, it was for debriefing and, getting more instructions. And then I was allowed to join my East German family for 2 to 3 weeks.
Oh, wow.
That was obviously also dangerous because, you know, there was a lot of international travel involved. I never did a direct flight from New York to Moscow, but there was always something in between. But nevertheless, these kinds of trips represented some danger. But to the KGB, to folks, it was important that I not lose touch with my homeland, that I not lose touch with the folks that I that trained me and that I had learned, gotten to like. They even asked me, for instance, while I was in the U.S., if I was interested in a site contact occasionally. You know what a site contact is? You go to a spot somewhere and you know across the street by a certain display window, there is somebody that you're looking for and there's a familiar face. And I said, I don't want this. I don't need it. I never felt lonely. I never got depressed. I only found out what depression is much, much, much later. It had nothing to do with espionage. I was playing a game. It was sometimes boring, but deep down inside, I knew, I was special and I relished the whole thing, And I also, when I earned some money, I took some very expensive stuff back home to my wife in Germany.
Well, she must have appreciated that for sure.
Tennis bracelet in East Germany was something that you couldn't buy. They didn't have them.
Oh, I see. So did she... She only knew your cover story, is that right? Or does she have any awareness of what you were really up to at all?
She knew K KGB and USA. That was it. And she married me knowing that this was going to be the case. She went into this relationship and this marriage with the eyes wide open. I had told her that this would probably be something like a 10-year mission. And so we were both hoping after 10 years that life would be back to normal. Well, it turned out to be completely different.
Yeah, for sure. So what did you work on besides trying to make contact with these conservative think tanks? Did you have any ever specific like short-term missions, like try to make contact with this person or find out this information or anything?
Yeah, I had some short-term missions, but my other major task was to be a spotter, talent spotter. Particularly since I went back, I went back to college, profile any number of students, as many as I can befriend, and send their profiles back to Moscow, who then determined as to whether they might be a good target for recruitment. No idea. I have literally no idea if any of these folks were ever contacted or even recruited, because that was another no-no. The rules of conspiracy were such that the spotter would, finger the person. That would the information would then be handed to a recruiter, who would then, upon successful recruitment, would hand this over, not directly, indirectly, to the handler. The spotter, the recruiter, and the handler never knew about each other, and nobody knew what happened, where the individual came from, and where the individual was going. So none of us could betray this person.
Okay, I see. So when you are spotting these people, are you establishing a personal relationship with them or just looking?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, you befriend them. Sure, yeah. Absolutely. So you need to get to know them to a degree where you can say, well, you know, this guy is very conservative. You could actually recruit him under false flag. And, you know, he's studying political science. He may wind up in government one day. You know, these kinds of things. You need to get a little bit into the head of the individual or else the profile is worthless.
Hmm. So were these people... You mentioned the false flag, so not all of these people would have been, for example, communist sympathizers, I guess?
No, in the 80s, the communist sympathizers were rather rare. Mm-hmm. I found a couple of them amongst the students who came from other countries, but within the United States, no way. I mean, the communist sympathizers pretty much died out in the late 50s. Earlier than that, the fishing grounds were well populated. There were lots of communist sympathizers, a lot of, you know, people who thought of communism in romantic terms, but that stopped.
Hmm. Okay. So do you recall about how many people you spotted and passed on over that 10 years you were here?
Honestly, that's a tough one. I would have to do some calculation because, remember, I only was limited to two letters every month. So, and you profile one, there's one sheet of paper, between 20 and 30 in that neighborhood.
Hmm. And none of those you ever bumped into again or had contact with again after that?
The answer is I am still friends with one or two who I'm pretty sure I profiled.
Hmm. Oh, wow.
But I never told him. Sure. Once I came out of the closet and became a public figure, if they had been approached, they would have told me because we're still friends.
Okay, so they might have been passed on by the KGB in that
case?
Yep. I see. So you mentioned you were here, you had like a 10-year mission approximately, and eventually I know you were... your mission ended. So can you tell us about how you found out the mission was over with, so to speak, and what happened then?
Well, we had a system of signals, very basic graphic signals for very basic communication. That is that a KGB employee who worked for the United Nations could send the signal with chalk mostly at a spot that I would walk by every morning, and I would also be able to set a signal where they would pass every morning. So things like I arrived in the country, or I received your radio transmission, or something like that. And one of those signals was was the danger signal, which was, unlike the white chalk, was something different, just very dramatic. It was a fist-sized red dot. One morning as I'm going to work, I walk past that spot, and I always habitually looked at the signal spot, which was a support beam of an elevated subway station in Queens. And lo and behold, I see the red dot. Now, you know, I got to tell you what I was thinking, even though it's not quite clean. My thoughts were, oh, shit. That was totally unexpected because, you know, I had no indication that I was in any kind of danger. And I, as I told you before, I was certain that I was trained well enough to find out whether I'm being investigated. Nobody had touched my apartment, and nobody had ever followed me. So, but they said that signal pretty much was a command. Come home, you know, make a beeline to the Canadian border, get your, I had a set of emergency documents, Canadian documents, take those documents and walk across the bridge at Niagara Falls and then go contact the Soviet embassy in Ottawa. And from there, I would have been exfiltrated. But you know, I had a problem. And the problem was, and maybe she can introduce herself at this point. Well, you were the problem. I mean, the prettiest problem one could ever have. It's Chelsea was 18 months old, and you know, and I'm telling people now that, you know, up until that point, I had played a game, but when I received this notification, I had to make a decision. And that's where I discovered that I was a human being, because I was, I had an attack of unconditional love. So the kind of love that you never get anything back other than a smile. But so I couldn't imagine leaving this child by herself with her mother. I tried to figure out ways to support her from a distance. And none of these things were feasible. And so I was now looking at a choice of A, the FBI really is on my case and I will get arrested. And B, if I don't follow that request, command, that the KGB would get angry with me and try to do me harm. All the good things for me were on the other side of the Iron Curtain. You know, I had a family. I had a lot of dollar savings that were accumulated there. And I had just the year before, I had received the second highest decoration of the Soviet Union. I would have gone home as a conquering hero. And yet, with all of that, on one side of the scale, on the other side was 20 pounds of Chelsea and a smile. And Chelsea won.
Sure. I can completely understand how family and you, and your children, they can really change everything. They can change your perspective and your priorities and everything. So I think a lot of parents, all parents have been there just about.
Well, but, you know, there's something special about Chelsea. She's got the biggest eyes that you will ever see, even nowadays. And so when those eyes looked at me, like, my heart skipped a beat. You know, there was something just magical about this child. And I guess all fathers feel the same way about their own children. But I got to be honest, Chelsea was unique. I have altogether 5 children.
Oh, wow.
And yep. And so she was probably the only one who could have influenced me in a way to act that I defied the KGB. And so, so after about a month of stalling and after somebody, actually an agent approaching me on the subway platform with the words that I will not forget until I'm gone, when he was saying, you got to come home or else you're dead, whispered that into my ears. That was, you know, knowing that the KGB wasn't very polite to defectors, that could be interpreted as a threat or some, you know, some kind of a bad use of English in that context. So anyway, I had to take it seriously. So I found a way out. I wrote my last letter in secret writing, and I said, listen, I would love to come home, but, you know, I have HIV/AIDS, and the only place where there's a chance of getting treatment is in the United States. And of course, in those days, AIDS were a definite death sentence, and they were not interested in having an AIDS-infected individual crossing the border into the Soviet Union. And it worked.
Yeah. What an amazing pretext you had there for getting out of that. This is what, 1988 or so? Is that right?
1988.
Yeah. There's a huge crisis, of course. And man, that's honestly like the perfect cover to keep on where you are.
Yeah. I told you it was pretty smart. that was in the past, you know, and I'm not so good anymore. But, you know, I don't know how I came up with that, but it was probably the only explanation that would keep them off my back. Anything else wasn't forcing. Anything else would have possibly been discovered as a lie. This one was, they had no reason to doubt me, because they knew that everything for me was going to be good when I got home. They didn't know about Chelsea, though.
Hmm. Oh, so you never reported her birth to them?
No, I never. Wow. I also never reported that I got married to an illegal alien. They would have ripped me to pieces if I had told them that. So what I did know is they kept at a distance. They never checked on me. Again, that was wise, because if you start checking on me, you might bring counterintelligence, the FBI in play.
Right, right. Good
point. I knew that they didn't check on me when I graduated as valedictorian from Baruch College in New York, and I had to give the speech, and there were about 4,000 people in the Felt Forum, and there was some press, and they didn't know about it, because if they had known about that, they would have reprimanded me too. So I knew that I was, whatever I told them is, that's the only thing that they knew about me. No more.
Hmm. Well, that worked out very well for you in the end then.
Yes, it did.
So Chelsea, I have to ask you now, I know that your father was putting an end to his time with the KGB when you were a baby, but growing up with him, I guess in the 90s, was there anything that you, I mean, how was it growing up with him? Was it just a normal childhood? Was there anything unusual about it now that you look back?
Yeah, I do talk about this a little bit in my documentary, but we were living in Brooklyn. We had a house nestled into a hillside, acres, with very few neighbors. It was pretty common to know all of your neighbors, right? So everybody knows everybody in this kind of neighborhood. There were a lot of things that I did notice that were out of the ordinary that made things feel kind of off for me, but that was intuitive, speaking to me more than blatantly obvious things that were that could be related to spy. For example, the house next door that we had, I never saw them come out of their house except for one time. The grass always cut. Back in those days, it was pretty common clothesline that you had, and they never used their clothesline. The blinds were always closed. I rarely saw any light coming out of the house at night or a car parked in the driveway. I later learned that the FBI bought the house, and FBI agents, my dad, that would explain why that house was always picture perfect, quiet, you know, nothing actually happening, no act, except for the one time my brother and I were approached by the two agents that were in the house, and I guess they were trying to like talk to mom that day. That's the only thing that happened that day.
Oh wow! How old were you when they approached you?
Around the time I started playing basketball. So I was around seven to eight, I think.
No, a little older, sweetheart. We moved to Pennsylvania when you entered fifth grade. So yeah. You must have been at least a little older.
Another one that was really obvious in my face that wasn't adding up was very, very young. When I was 4 years old, 3 or 4 years old, I asked my dad, where are you from? And I very clearly remember him saying he was from Germany. This, however, was well before we knew that I had any hearing issues. This out when I became and my hearing impairment is severe enough that I need hearing aids at the time. When I asked my dad the question again a few years later, when I was enough and I had already had aids, the answer changed to New Jersey. You have a hearing impairment, and most sounds, but they wouldn't know the difference here. If you have a hearing, I mean, it's very easy to miss what somebody is saying or hear wrong if the words are close enough. But my dad was so clever that he convinced me that Germany and Orange, New Jersey, sounded the same. The other alarming thing was, anytime I'd ask somebody's pass, there was nothing but just a cover story. And I didn't know this was a cover story at the time, but he had no mementos or photos of his pass. And anytime I asked him about it, all of my belongings were lost, and so I don't have anything. So, and then he had this story about my grandmother was a nurse, my grandmother had to help and blah, 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 all this stuff. This was a cover story too. I hope you just get it if you don't know any better. But I got interested and told me. When I later learned about my dad's story as an adult, put back on it, and I can now not only see the blaring, big things that were clear signs, but the little things that were adding up that were also anyone who was an adult at the time. There were definitely a lot of things. Now what those things are, now that I have the full story, but
right, yeah, I can understand that completely. How did you learn the full truth in the end?
Well, I had just my national letter of intent to play back. My biggest accomplishment at the time, I was trying to be the best athlete I could be. I became a Division I athlete. So I signed my national letter of intent on my way to college on a drive with my dad, and he decided to tell me the whole story. He alluded to this when I was 12 or 13. I asked him something more specific, and he's, when you're ready and when you're older, I'll tell you. So he chose to tell me on my way to school. And the drive from New Jersey at the time all the way to Loretto, Pennsylvania, where I was going to university, was about 4.5 hours. So every bit of that drive to tell me the whole story, he had left out that I had to have siblings. So that part comes later, but I didn't feel any anger towards him. I mostly was in awe of the fact. I just couldn't believe that this was the truth, that such an unusual story to hear from your parents. But it made everything make sense, right? So as I'm listening to him more and more about his past, I'm like, oh, okay, that explained the weird thing that is growing up. So my reaction was mostly, I was in awe and I was curious to see more that I could learn.
Sure, sure. So it's really hard for me to imagine learning all of that just in the space of a few hours, stuff that I haven't known that's been building up for 20 or close to 30 years at that point, I guess. Was there any disbelief on your part, or did it all click together immediately as soon as he started talking?
There was, I think it really all made sense once he told me. I took him at his word. And honestly, I mean, you got to think about in your day-to-day life now, if somebody comes out and tells you something that big and in that much detail with that length of time, take them at their word, And despite what people used to be, they're the great liars, great pretenders, right? He's probably the most honest person that I've ever met in my life. So
that's wonderful. That's high praise for sure.
So
Jack, Chelsea mentioned that the FBI bought the house next to your house. So how exactly did they catch on to you? Although this is after you've stopped spying. Is that right?
Yeah, that was 9 years. No, they introduced themselves 9 years after I stopped. They heard about me, I think about 5 years after I quit. And there was an archivist in the KGB archives who was in charge of the move of the archive from the Lubyanka in Moscow to the new facility outside of Moscow. And while he was, overseeing that work, he was very often left alone with some of the files. And he had developed a strong hatred towards the Soviet system. And the only way he figured he could do some damage is he started copying the files in handwriting onto little pieces of paper. He smuggled them every day, smuggled them out, either in his socks or in his underwear. And then he would type them up and hid the resulting paper buried in his dacha. And in 1992, he approached initially the Soviet Union was already gone. The KGB was not anymore. It had been split up into three different organizations. But anyway, he approached the CIA. The CIA was not interested. They didn't believe this guy. So eventually he made his way to the British embassy and they invited him and they believed him. And eventually he arrived in London with five suitcases full of paper with that much information. And on one of those pages, there was a little bit of something about Jack Barsky. Jack Barsky, illegal in the northeastern United States, no more. Now, that information got to the FBI, and since Jack Barsky is a rather unusual name, it didn't take him very long to come up with that's the guy who lives in Pennsylvania. So, and they took close to 4 years investigating me because all they knew was that I was a highly trained agent. What they didn't know is to whether I was still active or I was a sleeper or whatever. So they were very careful because I was in phenomenal catch. You know, the catch in illegal, anybody who's been working on this in the past will tell you it's next to impossible. And here they found one. Long answer. So I'm going to stop right here.
So they purchased that house near you and they were watching you for a long time, but I guess they didn't actually see you do anything because you weren't. Well,
exactly. Right? Now, sleepers won't do much of anything for a long period of time until they're woken up. But their observations also made them conclude that I was very Americanized and I was a family man and that I had a great relationship with my children and I would do anything not to lose the family. So eventually they decided to approach me and that's when my cooperation with the FBI started.
Was it a confrontational approach or a friendly approach?
It was reasonably friendly. So I got stopped by at a toll crossing across the Delaware by a state trooper who told me to drive to the side and get out of my vehicle. This is a routine traffic stop. I thought nothing of it because, you know, I was not in defensive mode at all. I knew that nobody would ever find me. And I would live my life out as, middle class, one of the faceless middle class people in the United States. And I had, come to accept that life that was ahead of me and that I would never see Germany again. So when at that moment, somebody came in from behind and as I'm turning around, he flipped open his ID, which I didn't look at. And he said, FBI, we would like to talk to you. Whoa. That was probably the most intense moment in my entire life. The agent reported later that, blood left my face because, there was an electric storm in my brain and all the bad things that could happen from that point on. I go to jail. My wife, the mother of my two children, would be extradited because she really wasn't a legal American because she got the citizenship based on being married to me. And obviously, I wasn't a legal American. And then the kids wind up wardens of the state and, go into foster care. So all of this, oh, my God, and what do I do? What do I do? Then they put me in a car and started driving north. I got my composure rather quickly. First, within 5 minutes, I asked the first question, am I under arrest? And the answer was just a short no. And then I waited another 5 minutes, and then I came up with a question that I instinctively used to try to break the ice. So I said, so what took you so long?
Oh my gosh. Oh wow.
That's my favorite part.
Yeah, but
and
that is validated by the agent. You know, they remember that there were two of them. They remember that. And because I still had never lost my sense of humor. You know, I make dentists laugh when they have a problem pulling my teeth. I always like try to find something comical in a particular situation. And I think that's the best way to deal with it because, you know, if you submit to the threats that are coming at you, then you most likely will lose. So, and, you know, at least one of the guys couldn't suppress a smile.
Probably weren't expecting that.
No. And then they took me to a motel and spent about 3 hours interviewing me for a preliminary interview. And I made sure that they understand that, hey, listen, I will do anything and everything I can to cooperate. I didn't ask for, you know, what I get in return. I would just say, I will cooperate. You know, I've lived here long enough. I have a family here. I have no more loyalties to my ex-employer. And so that started several week-long debriefing in the greatest of detail.
Hmm. So they wanted to know everything, of course. But in the end, you were never charged with a crime. Is that correct?
That is correct. And interestingly enough, which is something I didn't know, they could not have charged me with espionage. They didn't have any evidence for that. They could have only charged me with being in the country illegally. That's the only charge they had. I didn't know that. Regardless, that still could have put me in jail for 2 years. But or they would have sent me back to Germany. Yeah. Now the Germans wouldn't have known what to do with me. It would have been an interesting situation. Clearly, the Russians wouldn't want me back, and I wouldn't have known what to do in Germany. I'd maybe teach English.
Oh wow! Yeah, you haven't been there in so long.
Nope, I had no German skills in me left. You know, chemistry I had long forgotten, mm-hmm. and computers, it doesn't translate that well. Maybe I could have gotten a job long term in computers.
Hmm. Sure. So since you were never charged, were you able to go back to, you know, what you called that middle class life not too long?
Yeah.
After
that? Oh, absolutely. And now that with that burden, it wasn't a burden I was very aware of, but knowing that, you know, one day I will be really free, because eventually they told me after I passed the lie detector test that there is a path to citizenship. But it would take a while to clean me up, so to speak. They decided, and I was very glad they did, that they wouldn't want to put me in the witness protection program, which would have required changing IDs again. It would have required starting fresh. Would have required uprooting the children and the family. So, you know, I kept on doing what I was doing when they said hello. And now I really focused on a career, and it went well. I had a very nice ascent, and I started making really, really good money. You know, was able to buy a great house and was able to get Chelsea the pool that she always asked for. and the parrot. That she has been bothering me about. Well, African gray, they're expensive. but anyway, so yeah, that was, you know, I was then, you know, I became a typical sort of upper middle class consumer.
I see. So, and Chelsea, back to you. Were you aware of the day that he was picked up by the FBI and debriefed, or were you oblivious at the time?
I mean, I was absolutely oblivious, but I do remember him absent at one point where he just didn't come home. But I mean, my mom would be able to tell us what was going on. We just assumed it would work.
Okay. So it was never like that.
I had a good excuse. I had a good excuse when it got late, because you know, I worked in IT and we sometimes worked hard hours, late hours. So when they caught me, the FBI, they allowed me to call home and tell the wife that I would be late. And then they let me go. I came home around midnight, I think.
Oh, wow. So that same day. That's good.
Yeah.
So all of that is mostly behind you now. What are you up to these days?
I retired somewhat forcibly from my last job in IT. Wrote a book called Deep Undercover. I was discovered by 60 Minutes. That's how I became a public figure. I had nothing to do with it. They found me. And so now I'm doing, when it happens again, I've been doing quite a bit of public speaking. I write essays, whatever, you know, I play around. I'm trying to be creative. I love doing this kind of stuff. And we're about to conclude the work on a 12-part podcast about that features my story. It will be called The Agent and will come out late summer, early fall. And Chelsea is playing a prominent role in this. You know, there's many other voices that will appear in that podcast, which makes my story more three-dimensional and even much more interesting.
Oh, wow. I didn't know you were working on that. I'm really looking forward to that in that case.
Yeah, me too. It was a lot of work, and it's going to be good. I mean, we're almost finished.
Good. And you said it'll probably be out in the next couple of months. Is that right?
Yes. This will be heavily advertised, and clearly in my social media, people will be notified. But there's going to be some commercial advertising going on. So this is the company that's producing this is investing quite a bit of money in this.
Good. Well, I'll definitely spread the word as well as soon as it's available.
Yeah, and I tell you what, Chelsea gets a lot of play in the last episode. She rocks. I mean, I was just blown away by what she can come up with and how she can state the things that she says without knowing what the question was going to be. That's a skill it's a rare skill, and Chelsea is a pro. I'm telling you.
That's amazing. That's fantastic. I'm very excited about this, honestly. And Chelsea, I wanted to ask you, correct me if I'm wrong here, but you've done some outreach to the children of other former spies as well. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. In 2018, a documentary that I did with A&E about me was what kind of spearheaded that whole thing. And you can only see in the documentary only like two people that I talked to. I talked to a dozen people. I interviewed a lot of people. We filmed this over the course of a year. It's just not everybody made it into the final cut. Since that documentary has actually aired, I have been contacted by dozens more through social media who've seen my documentary, who have similar stories. More recently, I actually had a gentleman reach out to me whose father and mother were both North Korean intelligence. And I'm hearing more and more incredible stories as I go. Uh-huh. But the reason that I really wanted to connect with other children or family members of former spies is because it is such a unique position to be in. Nobody asks about the family members, what happened to them. And in or such as the KGB, there is no protocol to do with your family, how to tell your family what you're doing. You're not, if you look at CIA and FBI, they have with and how you tell your family and your children what you do for a living. And there's protection. There's no protection when it comes to the KGB. You're pretty much on your own, and so is your family. So one of the very first one I interviewed is Robert Korchak. He's the son of Boris Korchak, who is a double agent. This guy has a lot of terrifying stories. That's really why I took an interest in it. But I wanted to see for personal reasons what kind of similarities or differences we might have because of what our parents have done. So.
Oh, sure. I can imagine. It must leave you feeling terribly alone when you're considered, you know, like if your parent goes to jail for something like that and everyone thinks that reflects on you when you never knew anything about it.
Yes, absolutely.
That must be
so hard. There was one guy that I tried to get in touch with. I literally, like, for months, this journalist and I were trying to check. His name is Juan Lazaro. Both of his parents were found to be spies. He's from, his family's from South America. His mother's from Peru. He also grew up in the city where I'm from originally. And he is this incredible musician. He's a concert pianist. And I desperately wanted to talk to him because when he was 16, he was pretty much given the option of you stay here in the U.S. by yourself without mom and dad, or you get to go with one of them. I can't imagine having lost my entire world at any age before becoming an adult. I cannot imagine that. So I was never able to talk to him, but this is one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to him, because that's such a unique situation in which it has absolutely nothing to do with you. You don't get to choose to be in that situation. So of course you're going to feel incredibly alone when something like that happens. So my hope in connecting with other spy children was to make them feel a little bit less alone. That I have been able to talk to do feel less alone. It's a great feeling to be able to be a part of it and feel a little bit better about this scenario that has nothing to do with them. It's really not in their control.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, I'm really appreciative, and I'm sure they are really appreciative as well, as considering people who get caught up in this kind of thing through no fault of their own. So thank you for doing that.
Absolutely.
Well, I really appreciate both of you talking to me today. I wish we had more time, honestly, because you both have so much to offer. But I have had a great experience, and I think that the people listening now are really going to be interested in hearing about this as well. So thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Okay, take care. Goodbye. If you're interested in more of Spycraft 101, look for my page on Instagram at Spycraft101 or connect with me on Patreon. My patrons get exclusive access to long-form blog posts that dive deep into some of the most amazing stories in the history of espionage and receive free or discounted books and products from the Spycraft 101 store. I want to say a big thank you to all of my patrons, including Timon K. and Tyson S. With your support, I've been able to continue funding my research and publication across multiple platforms to date. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll stick around because there is lots more to come.
Thanks for listening to this program brought to you by Daydreamer Network. If you enjoyed the episode, please don't forget to rate and review on Apple Podcasts or your preferred platform. Your feedback allows us to rank on the best new shows list and continue to grow our podcasts in order to bring more unique and talented storytellers to the network. To check out our shows, including programs about relationships, sports, business, nutrition, leisure, and more, head to www.daydreamernetwork.com. We look forward to seeing you back next week for another great episode. Have a wonderful day.